Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Today, my colleague and co-host Sam Wong isn't with us, so I'll be having this conversation on my own. Today, we're going to be talking about Congress during the 1970s. Although this is a period where we often focus on the presidency, the downfall of Richard Nixon, the subsequent presidency, short presidency of Gerald Ford, and the Democratic presidency of Jimmy Carter, a lot was really going on in Congress. This is the period when many reforms attempt to change the way that business is done on Capitol Hill. We see the entrance of a new wave of legislators into both the House and Senate, who had a very big impact on the way that business was done, but also fell short of some of the changes they hoped to achieve. It was also an important decade for Democrats, as Republicans were steadily making gains and certainly doing pretty well in presidential politics. Democrats still held on to control of the House and Senate, which I think was a very important part of the politics during this period. Today, to discuss the class of 74 with us, which was arguably one of the most significant classes to enter into Congress, we have with us John Lawrence, who's a visiting professor at the University of California's Washington Center. John worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years, including as chief of staff to Speaker Nancy Pelosi. He also received his PhD in history at the University of California, Berkeley. And he is the author of a really fantastic new book, The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate, and the Roots of Partisanship, which just came out with Johns Hopkins University Press. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Julian. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So maybe we can start by having you tell us just a little bit about who was in the class of 74 and why is it such a distinct class of Congress?
Very often the class has been superficially described as just a group of young, very often disrespectful, often inexperienced young people who came to Washington pretty much designed to just shake the place up and disrespectful of the institution. Known most commonly as the Watergate babies. They, not surprisingly, were often described in that way by the powerful institution, the leadership of the Congress, the committee chairs and the elected leadership. But in fact, it was a much more diverse group than that. About half of the group had held public office. There were five mayors. There was a lieutenant governor. There were people who'd served in state and local office, about the same proportion as the rest of the House of Representatives. But there were also a lot of people who were new. Toby Moffat from Connecticut once said, "We were young. We looked weird. I can't even believe we got elected." There were people who were former congressional staff. There were educators. There were ministers. There was even one house painter, consumer advocates, people who came out of the civil rights and the consumer and the environmental movement. So they weren't necessarily traditional politicians, but they were people who knew about building political organizations. And they used that when they came to Washington, both in terms of addressing the institutional reforms that were necessary, in promoting the major issues that they thought were being ignored by the Congress, and in planning for their own reelections and building their own careers.
Now, they are elected, so the term Watergate babies really comes about because this is November of 1974, and just a few months after the resignation of Richard Nixon, and certainly one of the great scandals of American history. How, even though, as they are diverse and as they come from different backgrounds and different agendas, how does that event and the news and turmoil that came in the year plus before their election impact this generation as they come into Washington?
Well, combined with the cynicism and the frustration that had emanated from the Vietnam experience, Watergate really built, I think, a broad, even a bipartisan public demand for improvements in government, for reform in government, and particularly for increased transparency in government. Most of the people who I spoke with, and I interviewed over 40 people, members of the class and other members who were serving at the time, most of them told me that they didn't specifically choose to run because of Watergate. Much of the Watergate scandal was playing out over that period of time. Their major reason for running, they all told me, was because of concerns about Vietnam. But the overlying theme that government was too secretive, that the Congress was not playing an aggressive enough role, was not conducting investigations. These were all things that were broadly shared. They were shared by Democrats in the class. They were also shared by the Republicans in the class. Watergate certainly, while not a reason for them running, was a reason for many of them winning. Many of these people were winning in districts that had not elected a Democrat in decades. In some cases, like Wesso Coins in Oregon, had never elected a Democrat to Congress. And they pick up 49 seats from the Republicans, 76 new Democrats altogether, and clearly come into Washington in November and December of 1974 with a clear intention of making significant change in how Congress functions.
And so while Nixon might not really have been their target, it sounds like from your findings that the target really was the leaders of Congress, the senior committee leaders who had been in power for a while. What were they like?
So the committee system was the dominant system in Congress, even though we know about congressional leaders like Sam Rayburn. The power lodged over the preceding decades, really since 1910, largely in the committee system. The committee system was dominated by older, more conservative members who secured and kept their chairmanships because of the seniority system, which itself had been introduced as a reform in 1910 for a way of selecting chairmen in a nonpartisan, non-ideological way. Increasingly, through the 1950s and 1960s, as the Democratic caucus liberalizes with the election of newer, younger, post-war members, those chairmen are out of touch with the changing nature of the caucus, and they are resistant to much of the legislation, whether that's on energy or on women or on civil rights, certainly on Vietnam, that the growing reformist, younger members, more liberal members of the caucus are demanding. There are several attempts to force reforms. There are some reforms that are made in the 93rd Congress in the early 1970s, but there is no success in changing the seniority system itself. When the class of 74 arrives, they are not necessarily congressional reformers. Most of them, when I interviewed them, said they didn't really know very much about the efforts that had been made going back into the 1950s to open up Congress to make the chairman more responsive. It wasn't until they got there and they met people like Richard Bolling and Phil Burton, Don Frazier, Bob Kastenmeyer, these liberal reform leaders, that they realized that in order to accomplish any of their policy objectives, they were going to have to change the seniority system to make it clear that the chairs owed their positions to the caucus. And if they were resistant, if they opposed the caucus, they were not going to have an automatic right to those chairmanships anymore. Some of these Southern chairmen were voting 75% of the time and more against their own party. They were really in this conservative alliance with most of the Republican members. And that was simply intolerable to the reformers.
And you start the book with a story that involves Congressman Downey of New York. Can you tell us a little bit about that story, which takes us into those first few months when this class was in power?
I used that story at the very beginning, and I, as soon as I heard it, I knew that had to be the way I would start this book, Julian, because it symbolizes the shock that so many of these these older members experienced with the infusion of this class of 74. I start the book by talking about the Congressman Barrett of Pennsylvania, on the floor, as he typically would have been during a normal legislative day, early in January of 1975. He had no real familiarity with most of these new people who had arrived, and he was reading some of his papers and signing some letters, and as he did probably hundreds and hundreds of times in the many years that he had served in Congress, he summoned over one of the young people who was in a blue suit and a white shirt and tie and long hair, and said to one of these people, who he assumed naturally was going to be a page, since he looked very young and was dressed in a page outfit, here, take these papers to my office. And the young man responded in words that I'm not sure you use on your podcast, but they were not considered suitable ways for addressing a senior member of the House. Barrett then summoned over one of the leaders of the cloakroom, one of the managers, and said, look, this page just told me to do something which you're not supposed to say on the floor of the House of Representatives. And the cloakroom manager said to him, well, I'm sorry, Mr. Barrett, but this page is your new colleague, Tom Downey of New York. Downey was only 25 years old, and but he was an experienced political person. He had actually already held elective office for several years in Suffolk County, New York. But that kind of clash, where it was almost incomprehensible to these older people that they were going to have to accept these young people, let alone be accountable to them. When one of those chairmen, Edward Hebert, the Armed Services Committee chairman, very conservative, pro-Vietnam War chairman, was brought before the new members caucus, as were all the chairmen, to explain why they deserved to be chairman again. He began by leaning on the table and saying, well, boys and girls, let me tell you how we run this place. And that alone just sent the signal that he was hopelessly out of touch with these younger members of Congress. And he was one of the three that they voted to remove as chairman.
And one of the really interesting parts of the book is that you talk a lot about and think about the effects, the political effects of this election. It comes, obviously, if Watergate had not happened, you were talking about a two-term Republican president who wins his reelection in 72 by, very substantial margin. All the historians of this period really focus on the rising power of conservative movements and a rightward direction of politics. It was an aberration in that the Democrats did really well in the middle of all this. What was the effect of that politically on how Democrats thought about the state of the country and the direction of their party?
Well, I think that's a really important point because, of course, we all look now back through the lens of Watergate and see this Democratic hegemony over the House, which extends from 1954 until 1994 and actually goes back to 1932 with only 4 years of Republican control in all that period of time, over 60 years. But in fact, by the late 1960s, with the aftermath of the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Bill, with the movement of black voters into the Democratic Party and the movement of many white conservatives out into a reemerging Southern Republican Party, with the Wallace campaign of 68 and the Nixon Southern strategy, there are people beginning to envision the Republicans gaining enough strength in the South and the border states to begin to challenge the assumption that Democrats had a natural lockdown majority in the House of Representatives. And Kevin Phillips actually writes a book, The Emerging Republican Majority, in 1968, where he says, we are on that trajectory because these seats that have been safe Democratic seats are safe Democratic seats no more because of these changes, particularly in the South and in the border states. But then Watergate comes along, and in 74, in the post-Watergate election, it takes the Republicans 10 years to get back to where they were in 1972. They lose so many seats, and even though they chip away at them because many of them are not secure seats, and by 1982, half of the class of 74 is not there anymore. But even so, it takes another takes an entire decade just to get back to that period. And of course, the way the Republicans are getting back is increasingly with the election of a much harder edge, much more partisan, much more adversarial and confrontational Republican group out of the South, largely Gingrich being among them, but certainly others like Vin Weber are important, and Bob Bauman and the like, who are much more confrontational and anticipate the idea that they will contest for the chairman for the majority. Interestingly, I relate this story in the book. A group of the class of 74, George Miller among others, goes to Tip O'Neill after the 1980 election, and in which the Reagan is elected president, the Republicans gain control of the Senate for the first time since 1954, and they say, you know, we're a little concerned here that we could find ourselves losing the control of the House. Phil Burton had always warned, take care of the Southerners and the conservatives or you're going to lose the majority of the House. And O'Neill dismissed them, just completely dismissed them. I think that it's really significant because despite all these changes that are occurring, the Republicans dominating at the presidential level, the Republicans regaining the Senate, this significant ideological shift and party revitalization of the Republicans in the South, Democrats really, and much I think of the media and the press, are oblivious to this kind of looming threat that is out there. I think Democrats agree with many political scientists and many of the journalists that there is this natural Democratic majority that is always going to be the backstop, which is going to prevent the Republicans from being as successful as they anticipate they might be. And they're really wrong. And that comes to fruition, of course, in the late 80s and then particularly in the early 90s when the Republicans accomplished exactly that goal. But certainly, I think there was throughout this period a full sense of Democratic optimism, which propelled the party and was oblivious to much of that changing demographic in the southern states.
Now, the class has to deal with a Republican president still, Gerald Ford, who's pretty conservative on most issues. Certainly, he's going after spending, and he's not that excited about a lot of the priorities of the various figures you're talking about. Are they able to achieve success on the legislative front during that period between their election and Jimmy Carter's presidency, or are most of the changes internal in terms of changing how Congress works?
Certainly most of the changes were internal, and one of the great frustrations that I document in the book, on both on the part of the freshmen and others in the House, is that they cannot replicate in their legislative battles the kinds of successes that they were able to achieve on reforms. The freshman class is not a particularly divisive group on policy matters. They actually do stick together. And even into the Carter years, there is a memo which I got a hold of, which I relate in the book, that the freshmen are this class of 74 is a very loyal Democratic group. They do vote with the party. The problem is that when they can pass legislation, given these large numbers that they have, and I use the example in particular of some jobs legislation and the situs picketing reform, a major labor reform, which had President Ford's support at one point, when their veto comes, they can't override the vetoes because the old conservative coalition, that old group of conservative Democrats, ally with the Republicans, who are, of course, going to stand up for the president. The president was the Republican leader in the House, very popular among the Republican House members, and they can't override those vetoes. And they become very angry, particularly at their own leadership, Carl Albert in particular, for not being able to persuade the party members, the more conservative party members, for joining with them to override these vetoes. The bills often didn't pass with veto-proof majorities originally, so it's not that they're losing votes. They shouldn't have been surprised, but they are very frustrated that they have these large majorities into the 290, certainly enough to be veto-proof, but they cannot generate the overrides that they wanted. To the extent to which they thought they might be able to maybe cut more deals with with Ford, the rising threat of Ronald Reagan on his right certainly makes that a non-operational by early 1976. The threat to Ford's renomination is very real, and Ford is wary of any action he might take that would look to be overly conciliatory to the Democrats that would cost him votes. And he was right to be conservative and to be concerned. That fight with Reagan went all the way to the Republican convention in the summer. So Ford was disinclined to in any way be viewed as conciliatory to this Democratic majority that he had to deal with.
You write about the Republican reformers. So there's reformers in both parties, or there's a class of 74 from different partisan perspectives. What were the Republicans like of this cohort?
Well, the Republicans actually had favored reforms. The Republicans as a party had favored some of these reforms earlier, changes to seniority and certainly reforms that opened the system up to greater participation, to greater ability to offer amendments, because as the minority, that served their best interests. So there was a natural feeling among even more traditional Republicans that they would have liked to have seen a more open House, because a more open House meant greater rights to the minority. In fact, some of the reforms that were done in 74 did give more staff to the minority and otherwise help their position vis-a-vis the committees and the subcommittees. Within the class of 74, there were a number of reformers who were elected, people who were viewed themselves very much as bipartisan, people like Larry Pressler and Chuck Gradison, Millicent Fenwick, who said that they were frustrated by the fact that on the one hand they were sympathetic to reform, but they couldn't really participate in the efforts that were ongoing in 1974, 1975, because they were all taking place within the Democratic caucus. That was the only place where the reformers would have sufficient numbers to effectuate the reforms. And on the other hand, they felt increasingly alienated from the conservative, the harder line conservatives that are growing in power in the Republican Party, because they don't really view themselves as being quite as hard line. And they expressed to me feelings of that they were sort of alone in the wilderness, and neither trusted by the Republican leadership nor by the Democratic reformers. I think it's Larry Pressler who was telling me at one point that he was supporting an amendment in the Education Committee for a bill that was on the floor, and his Republican leadership wouldn't give him time. They said, you know, you vote too much with the Democrats, go get time from them. So these Republicans were very much left in a sort of a political netherworld. And increasingly were concerned as they saw the more evangelical, hardcore, ideological right gaining power in the party and in the House. Now, interestingly, several of them did say to me, however, that had they remained in the House, and a large number of them don't, they run for the Senate in order to get out of this environment in the House in some cases, and other cases such as Gary Myers in Western Pennsylvania, he just quits. He's just too frustrated by the whole process. But they do tell me, these even the moderates, that had they stayed in the House, they probably would have been sympathetic to the more aggressive Newt Gingrich approach of dealing with the Democrats in the 1980s, because they felt that the Republican Party continued to be marginalized. Of course, it's marginalized in large part because the Democrats start backtracking on some of the reforms, which they feel are being exploited by Republicans in order to target more marginal Democratic members. So Democrats, in fact, behave in a way that confirms the very indictment that Republicans are throwing at them, which is that they're abandoning reforms and they're tightening down the operations of the House, making them less transparent and less participatory.
As it writing a book, you write it from two perspectives. You did graduate work in American history at one of the best institutions. You read a lot of historical work, and yet you also served in the institutions at the highest levels of power and worked with many of the people you wrote about and lived your life in the institution. How did that impact both how you researched the story, but just as important, how you ended up telling the story?
I think that being there as a historian, and as you say, I was there for almost 40 years, made me view a lot of what I observed and also what I participated in and effectuated in something of a different way. Because of that historical experience, I was very much aware of how much goes on that very often doesn't make it into the formal accounts, whether it's political science or history, but even the journalistic accounts, that so much is written from the standpoint of what the end result is, as opposed to how you got to the end result, how the members interacted with each other, how what appears to be a political agreement was actually reached. And you're very aware of the fact as you're in these meetings, you know, and when I was the chief of staff to the speaker, I was in meetings with senators and cabinet members and presidents. And you can't escape this notion that some point one of my historian or political science colleagues are going to write about the decisions that are made in this meeting, and they're probably going to get them wrong because they're only going to have a tiny fraction of what actually available. They're only going to have a tiny fraction of what actually occurred, what actually was said. And of course, they're going to have that based on what someone else has given them, because very often there's very little in the way of notes that are taken. I made a point, particularly during my years with Mrs. Pelosi, is keeping very scrupulous notes of virtually every meeting and conversation that I was in, and that included both formal meetings, but also telephone conversations, and both in the House and the White House and the Senate. And those, I think, are valuable because they may well be the only account of some of these conversations that exist.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, but you have a lot more to say, and I suspect you have more books to come. But thanks very much for joining our episode. Again, this is John Lawrence, who is the author of a really fantastic book, The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship, which is out now with Johns Hopkins University Press and available everywhere you can find books. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Julian.
And thanks again to everyone for joining our show. Once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.